This podcast is proudly supported by Drama Victoria. Become a Drama Victoria member today to take advantage of the many member benefits. This podcast was recorded on the land of the Bunurong people. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Hello and welcome to The Aside, a podcast for drama teachers and students. I'm Nick Waxman and today we are speaking with Karen Johnson Mortimer. She is a distinguished director and choreographer. She began her career at 15 in Anything Goes. She is the associate director of the Australian tour of Wicked and has also held the role for Dirty Dancing, Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Wizard of Oz, Saturday Night Fever, Pippin, Chicago the Musical and the 60th anniversary production of My Fair Lady with Dame Julie Andrews. She's also Grease the Arena Spectacular. Karen's choreographic achievements include the Sydney 2000 Olympics. A former performer, she's appeared in a chorus line and was a regular on the Don Lane Show. We are talking with Karen Johnson Mortimer about her role as the Associate Director of Wicked. We're going to be breaking this interview into two chunks. We've got the Unit 3 Theatre Studies questions and the Unit 4 Theatre Studies questions. We're going to focus on Unit 3 for this episode, but I strongly encourage you to listen to both. There's so much overlap between Unit 3 and Unit 4, and her responses are so rich and so detailed. You are going to learn so much from listening to her. She's been with the show for such a long time. This was a fabulous opportunity to talk to one of the creatives behind the scenes and to hear her insights on what is a worldwide phenomenon. Without any further ado, I bring you Karen Johnson Mortimer.
Hi there. Good morning. How are you?
Hello. I'm fabulous. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Well, I'm in the theatre at the moment. We're about to have our first little audience. We've been in a week of rehearsals and technical rehearsals and, layer upon layer. And today's layer is now bringing in some real live people to hear some reaction from them.
That's really exciting, having live humans giving a reaction in the flesh. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's really important. It's really important, particularly because we've already had one season in Sydney and, new city, new vibe. And Melbourne, of course, as we know, is one of, one of Australia's greatest theatrical capitals. So we want to give our very best to the audience and we want to know and feel how they feel about us. So today is very important.
So exciting. Well, staging an internationally acclaimed work like Wicked is exciting. It's a dream come true. Can you briefly explain how the design, creative concept, and direction is transferred to the Australian team? So basically, what does an associate director like you do?
Like most overseas productions, you are engaged by the originating creators and their associates. In my case, for Wicked, I went to New York and had an initial meeting with Lucy, the associate director from Wicked in New York. And basically, the meeting was to discuss my responsibilities and expectations of being able to be the caretaker and the director in this country or the associate director in this country of this iconic show. The things that they really wanted to make sure that you are across is particularly that the clear narrative of the original, of the vision of the original creators. So you have to, they chat to you and see that you really do understand that, and not a sort of just taking a shortcut approach to be able to, technically put on the show without holistically creating that whole experience. So, yeah, you do that. They want the Broadway production to be very pure and untouched. Of course, with different actors, it gives us different sort of life. But nevertheless, it's something that's very, very important. I mean, this show has been running for 20 years, and there's a reason for that. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's, it's pure, it's real, and it's great storytelling across. As well as that, I also have to be across design elements, set, costumes, makeup, lighting, sound, plus effects. I've got to make sure that everything gels, everything is clear so that the performance is seamless. So that's how you get the job, to be able to say, yes, I can do that. And then, you discuss and you go back and forward and then the reins are handed to you.
Great. What a task. What a mammoth job you've got.
It is, but it's... it's something I believe in my case. I started in the theatre when I was, as you said, 15. So I've come up through the ranks through all different departments. And eventually, you know, you just pull those skills together and you have great mentors in your life. And one of my greatest mentors was Betty Pounder, who worked for J.C. Williamson's all those years ago. And she did exactly the job that I did. She did it incredibly without the technology that we have today. She used to go to New York and she had a photographic memory and write things down in notepads and come back and create those shows exactly as they were on Broadway. So, yes, I had a great mentor and a great teacher to be able to let me continue that role.
That's incredible. So the theatre studies curriculum and study design is broken into two units, Unit 3 and Unit 4. Some students are seeing this production for Unit 3, and we're going to start with those questions, and then we'll have a separate episode for Unit 4. We'll start with the first question. In your mind, how was the context of the original script interpreted in this production in 2024?
I think, well, as I said before, our production is a replica of what's on Broadway. Nothing has changed as far as the context of the script is concerned. When you go back, if you go back, Joe Mantello, who directed the original production, but go back further, go back to Gregory Maguire, who this show was based on the novel. He said at that particular time, he wanted to, The Wizard of Oz really, when he was a child, totally affected him. And he was both fearful and excited about the Wicked Witch's story. He said as he sort of grew and was, the way that it affected him just kept making him wonder about it. And he said, and I finally decided what I wanted to do was just to explore more the Wicked Witch's story, deepen the mystery, basically, but also give us some reasons. So that is the, you know, that's the crux of this whole show. So you can't change the context because that's what the original writer wanted, and that's where everything was taken from Stephen Schwartz right through to Joe Mantello. So no, it hasn't, there's no changes. Of course, as I said, if you get new actors playing the role, they have nuances and characteristics that might affect their interpretation, but the story of their character is still the same.
Fabulous. Thank you. That's really clear. So you think it's just keeping true to the playwright's original intention? It hasn't been modernized or adapted for 2024. No real changes to suit today's social political climate. Do you feel like there's any shifts in tone or characterization to talk to 2024, or that just a natural progression of actors, contemporary actors, bringing this story to life? Or is it really trying to stay true to that original production?
Yeah, I think so. And to be honest with you, there's the story is created in a specific world, an imaginary world. But in that imaginary world, the things that we're talking about, you know, social media, all the, you know, the different things that everybody is affected by in 2024, I don't think it's any different from 100 years ago. I mean, there's still racism, there's still propaganda, there's still never judge a book by its cover. That, you know, there's still, everybody's life is, you know, has a journey somewhere in friendship, whether it develops into a fabulous long-lasting friendship or a short friendship, or why two people come together as being friends. They're all relevant, still as relevant today as they were back then. And what it is, what Wicked does is just shine a light on it. To, you know, to make you look at yourself again, or maybe not look at yourself, but just to shine a light to say, you know, life is exactly the same as far as those things that I talked about as they were so many years ago. I mean, it's history. What do people say? History just keeps repeating itself. It's just new players.
In your opinion, what is or what are the most distinct theatrical elements of this interpretation or this production?
Oh, so many, but I think, for me, that's a great question, isn't it? Do you want to be here for an hour, do you? No, I think for me, let me tell you a story. When this show first opened 20 years ago, I was in New York and I saw the show 3 months after it opened. I heard the hype. I knew nothing about it. I hadn't read the book. All I know that everybody was talking about this show, Wicked. So, I was there with my husband. Of course, it was the hottest ticket in town, so I tried to get some tickets. So I could only get one, and it was right at the back of the gods, as we call it, the upper dress. And I hadn't had an experience like that in the theatre for years, where I just felt totally, you know, taken away and transformed by everything that happened on that stage. Of course, it was everybody that was fantastic, the originating cast, but deep down, it was the score. It was Stephen Schwartz's score. And, I, you know, now after having worked on the show for sort of 14 years, you just really, you know, every moment musically is heightened or pinpointed, or something in an orchestration that just pings you in your heart, or, you know, that, which is what I was talking about earlier, gels with what's happening on stage with the actors. It's breathtaking. And from the back of that theater in New York, that music went right through my core. So I think the score is, you know, right up there. It should be, you know, named with the cast. It's another cast member. That's what the score is. That is what the orchestra is.
It's an exceptional pieces of music and wonderful motifs that keep repeating throughout the work, something that students can really look at. Are there any particular musical motifs or moments that you think resonate with you particularly, or for 14 years it's too hard to pinpoint one?
Oh, it's pretty hard to pinpoint one, because the longer you're with it, the more, you know, I ask maybe of the students, there are, Stephen Schwartz, there are tiny little moments or seconds throughout the score, and I'm still to pick up all of them. I've picked up a couple, but that are a nod to the music from The Wizard of Oz. You've got to listen hard, and maybe you have to see the show a few times to see it. But I think that interwoven sort of character is lovely too. But I love For Good, the song at the end when the witches come together and when the witches finally are saying their goodbyes. I love For Good. I just think it's, you know, such a beautiful moment. Of course, everybody, Defying Gravity, who can't love, you know, Grab Your Power and Take It Away. I mean, it's, yeah, too many. What can I say?
I think there's some subtle allusions to Somewhere Over the Rainbow during that song as well. I think they take the melody and they really abstract it and play with it. There's some really great resources on how to find where those melodies overlap. I'll actually put some links in the episode description if you want to look at some YouTube videos that have done a deep dive into some of the music of Wizard of Oz and how it's appeared in Wicked. Some of these incredible moments in the piece were designed by other creatives on the original Broadway team. Do you have any insight into how some of these decisions were made, how they took, you know, small stage directions in the script and then brought them to life in a grand scale? Do you know aware of any of the inspiration behind some of these distinct elements?
One thing I really was interested in to learn was when they finally got to the stage in putting the show together, and they got to the readings, and then they got to the go ahead to take the next step and start to engage and sort of look at people to create the sets and the costumes and all of that. And they had a lot of people walk in, you can imagine, with differing, you know, high tech spectacular things, if we're going to make a fly and all of that. And then the story goes that Eugene Lee came in and he had a model, he had a little white model that he sat, you know, which is the way I know of every show I've ever been on from 1971. Yes, I said that. You know, you started the show with the set model. And apparently he came in with that, and they said it wasn't full of color, but it was this little village, and a little sort of world where everything was made to, even though we have high tech in the show, was made to look like it was cast created or cast moved, like from the very top of the show when the monkeys come down and then they turn to one another and they crank, and it's like they're pulling up the curtain as we go into Oz. They said it felt like he had created what the wizard would, his little cart in The Wizard of Oz, maybe exploding, and all of these gadgets came out and all of these, you know, little tiny set pieces. So I found that really interesting, and when you look at it, it's such a clever device, but it creates a fabulous world in our show. And if you really look at it, it's simple and it's easy as far as things move, and the lighting design is so spectacular, but things just get trucked on, pushed off, you know, it's nothing over elaborate, but identifies and establishes where we are.
Okay. Can you think of any moments in the work or this interpretation of the work, which is, as you said, many years old, but our 2024 version, are there any production or design choices or directorial choices that enhance the audience's understanding of the play's themes? I think there are moments that really indicate the themes of the work.
I think particularly with the witches concerned, that quick leap from the very beginning of the show, where Elphaba arrives at she's university, finally thinking that, her life is about to change. She's smart, like she's such an intellect, and she's all of those sort of things. And she thinks finally, she's only been allowed to come because her sister's going there. So, but for her, it's a release, it's a freedom. And she's had to put up with, all her life, people just being freaked out by her or screaming at her or all of that because she's green. She thinks coming to this university, things are going to be better because people are smarter. It takes 30 seconds before everything collapses and they all start, running and hiding and all of that. And then in comes the blonde girl and she has her gang around her. And so in that immediate time, Elphaba knows, no, nothing's going to change. I love the leap from that into loathing, because that then sets up all of everything we're saying about not judging a book by your cover, by its cover. So that part I really think brings out the main message of it, and that sets up then the journey of how this friendship deepens and how they both get changed by one another.
Absolutely. And Madame Horrible has this interesting turn as well, but I think it plays on those themes of propaganda, perhaps. Do you agree with that journey for Horrible is important or not
Oh,
really?
absolutely important, because it's interesting to find out who has the most power. And it's, I mean, the wizard, as is the story of the Wizard of Oz, he landed there. All of a sudden, people thought he was fantastic and he became a king overnight, a king with no power. So we have Madame Horrible, who is sort of his offsider, and she is, she can do some spells and everything, but are not enough. So the two of them work very closely together, but she, well, this is my thoughts about it. She doesn't quite know that he is as much as a sham as he is at the beginning. She sort of kind of believes, but so she wants to be up with him. She wants to be, his right hand person. And it's when we finally get into, so she's evil. He's not evil. He's just power hungry. Loves adulation, loves all of that, but he's not evil, but he gets swept into it. And then finally, when they bring Elphaba, and he says, when she says, "You can't read this book at all," and he says, "Exactly," that's when the veil comes down. And I think that's the first time Morrible realizes, "Oh, okay." And then she goes, "We've got her. I'm in charge now. I'll take care of things." And then she twists that balcony scene, and she becomes a wicked witch.
Yeah, a great moment to highlight. Excellent part of the script. That turn is really important for the show. So many moments in the work. And it's funny that you can just say a word and songs come to life in our heads. It's so great. The score is so powerful. So the elements of theatre composition are part of the theatre studies study design. They include motion, emphasis, rhythm, variation, contrast, cohesion. Can you think of an example of each of those in the work that might be really evident for an audience, or something maybe subtle that you'd like to point out?
Definitely.
Awesome. So let's start with motion, the movement or implied movement of actors or design features in the theatre space. It could include position, pattern, arrangement, proportion, spatial flow. Can you think of an example of motion in the work?
Absolutely. I think choreographically, this show was informed and influenced by obviously the designs. So if you look at most of the ensembles, costumes and everything, they're sort of always off kilter, not quite straight, angles, hems, hats, tilted, all of that. The choreography and the motion of the choreography reflects that as well. It's classical, but if you look at it a little closer, it sort of is, but with an odd twist. And they, the lines in the movement in the choreography really embellish the oddness of Oz. I think that that's probably a good way of explaining motion. I think that's mainly with the choreography. The staging so much is pretty straight clear. I think the ensemble with their tracks in the show create, enhance the motion of the show.
Absolutely. And you've already talked about the flow and how the pieces come in and come out and how it's like the wizard's card has exploded. And I think that was a really fantastic example as well with the monkeys and the curtain. That was really great. The flying monkeys, sorry. Why don't we talk about cohesion, which is just evident throughout this entire work. I don't know how you'll pick just one, but cohesion, the unity of balance of various aspects of the interpretation. Can you think of an example of cohesion in the work where maybe blighting sound, set, acting all works together to create a clear vision?
I think the best example of cohesion is Elphaba Flying. I think when they race, they come from the scene. She escapes from the wizard's chamber. She races out of that elaborate big Oz head and all that sort of beauty and awe, and races as she's escaping, and the guards are chasing her, and then they end up into the tiny attic. And it looks the way that the stage, that the lighting affects it. It looks like it is a tiny attic, and there's nowhere out. Two sort of like little shelves sitting there, and then we hear that's very dark, and you're scared because you think there's no way out for her. And then all of a sudden, this is my when Morrible's up on the balcony, and then starts with that Citizens of Oz, and starts the propaganda about we have to find her and capture and kill her. The lighting is just on her head. I call it floating heads. I don't know if anybody's been to Disneyland, but if they've ever been to the ghost house there, that I remember years ago when I took my kids, how frightened I was of just disembodied heads, and I think that's the next thing that we see. We throw back down to Elphaba, and she is just in a special with Glinda. It's dark, it's scary, and then she picks up her strength and decision not to be to stay true to her morals. She's going to do that. She'll escape, but she's not going to be bought. And as she grows and starts to find a strength and move around the stage, she opens up the stage a little bit, and she's moving side to side, so you get a sense of freedom, as if she's not cornered by these two sort of shelves around her. And then she magically brings the broom. She doesn't know what spell she's creating, but the broom arrives. It flies in. Things are starting to open up, gently open up, but still very dark. Then the broom comes down, and the two of them to make the decision. And Glinda steps back. Elphaba, they basically say, "Get out of here now. They're going to break down that door. Get out of here." She races upstairs and you think she's gone. It's just black. Everything's black. And then the guards race in, and they're just sort of pushing Glinda back and forward and back and forward, and then finally you hear Elphaba's voice, and a special hits her, and you just see her face coming forward, and everything's starting to just become alive. And as she travels forward and then she flies up, the whole stage opens, and it looks like one giant black cape flying with her above everybody. So I think that the cohesion of the set, our automation, our lighting, our cast, our orchestration is probably the best version, the best example of cohesion I can give for this show.
And incredibly well described. Thank you. That was incredible listening to that. What a beautiful moment. It's such a powerful example of how theatre can excite and challenge and delight us. It's brilliant. And then there are moments of course, you indicated rhythm in that answer as well. But can you think of an example of rhythm, the pace, timing, and tempo within the interpretation? Are there certain scenes that you think that rhythm is really important?
This whole show is cleverly written from text to song, and nothing in it. I don't ever feel, well, actually, I don't, I should never feel that we are just finished a scene and here's a song just to go with it. It's always seamlessly, the dialogue blends into the narrative is continued in the song and the lyric. Here's an example. So the top of Act Two, when they sing "Thank Goodness" and they're talking about the Wicked Witch, and there's all Madame Morrible is delivering dialogue as well as song, but rhythmically everything has to happen on a beat, an offbeat. You speak now, you speak then. So it's a lot of the show is like that, where the actual orchestration underneath you needs to be adhered to and keeping that rhythm. Here's another example of why you have to keep that rhythm. There's a scene in that actual scene where Glinda and Fiera walk downstage and have this sort of argument on downstage, right? There is the underscoring going on, and there's a moment of confrontation, and Fiera has to sort of think, what's he going to do? Is he going to stay or is he go? So it's a pause. Now, if he pauses too long, the oboe player can expire down in the pit because he's holding a note. And we have to say, you take your moment now, come in, otherwise. So that's, yeah, rhythm, very important for all
that's
concerned.
Important timing in that moment.
Yes,
very save the oboist.
Time. Yeah, yes.
I mean, I think we've just finished talking about defying gravity, but there are maybe other moments in the piece as well. Emphasis is one of the elements of theatre composition, aspects of the interpretation that are given particular focus, importance, or prominence. And I wonder if you can think of an example of emphasis from this work, this show full of brilliant emphasis.
All of them, but perhaps a very good example would be One Short Day, which is when Elphaba and Glinda finally arrive at the Emerald City. And the whole of the staging and the set and the lighting is such a nod to the Wizard of Oz, emphasizing, you know, the wizard himself in three giant sort of we call them flatheads, but you know, jolly characters that race out and sort of dance, and everyone's around being so excited, singing about the wizard. So it's emphasis on that. Here you are. You're going to meet the wizard. Here's three of them, just to give you a little bit of excitement before you actually walk into the door. Elphaba's excitement about being there is emphasized by her being given green glasses, by people taking photos of her, by, you know, characters coming and dancing around her, enticing her to come up. It's all that whole number is about making her feel comfortable and excited about finally walking in and meeting the wizard in the Emerald City.
Yeah, brilliant example. Contrast is throughout this work. Look at the contrast between our two lead characters, maybe the contrast between Nessa when we first meet her and then when we see her as governor of Munchkin Land. Contrast plays a big role in this piece. Can you think of an example of how contrast or the juxtaposition of seemingly different or opposing aspects or qualities within the interpretation?
Yeah, I think Nessa's a perfect example of that. I think she, I think when we first meet her, she's sweet, but she's spoiled. She's daddy's little girl, and Elphaba isn't. And Nessa just comes to expect, without being mean, comes to expect that Elphaba is there for her, to help her, to do everything for her. That's her, and also, you know, she's finally, with the help of Elphaba, being allowed to enjoy, you know, the fun of being at school and meeting new friends and having someone ask her out. So she's sweet, and we feel for her, but we're excited for her. Yes, twist it, act two, and things haven't turned out so well, and she's in a situation where she never wants to be. She finally had, she thought, the boy that she wanted to be with, but has discovered that he doesn't want anything to do with her. And her will and want, because the power that she has now as governor, cruelly keeps him there. She's trying not to have him as a servant, but she's so spoiled. She's so self-absorbed that she now has the power to do anything she wants. And even if he doesn't want to be there, she's going to make him stay there, and she's somehow going to turn him around to be, you know, be there happily. And when Elphaba comes in, there's no thanks for anything Elphaba's ever done for her. All she can think about is herself now, totally herself, being on her own, and just degrades her basically with the way that she speaks. So I think that's the Nessa's story, and Nessa's transformation from act one to act two is a perfect contrast. I think too, I mean, it subtly goes through, of course, because the journey of the two witches is the show, but the contrast from the beginning when they first sing Loathing to when they sing For Good. Perfect contrast. She's now on the other foot for both of them, and it's a deep friendship.
Absolutely. It's such a beautiful, touching moment in the show too. And our last element of theatre composition and the last question for Unit 3 is about variation, which is slightly different to contrast, because contrast is two things opposing each other or massive difference, and variation is those changes to the dynamics in the interpretation. Could be use of tension, conflict, intensity, energy, and use of space, how that is varied in the work. Can you think of an example in where we see variation occur?
Absolutely, and I think The Witch Hunters is probably the Witch Hunters scene in Act 2. I think is a very good example of variation, because what we see is the mob that want to kill. They want to find her and they want to get her, and they have all of the tools and the weaponry that, you know, that they charge to you, charge straight to the front to you, and it's just massive movement on stage and using the whole of the deck of the stage. And then all of a sudden, we jump up to Bok, who is now the Tin Man, and it, as opposed to he's talking to them, but he's in a tiny, tiny spot. So it's almost like a vignette. All of a sudden, their wide expanse, but he's talking to them from a small room and explaining it wasn't only him, but the lion cub that was affected by this dreadful, wicked, wicked witch. So he's talking to a giant crowd. Then, bang, we go over to the other side of the stage, and it's like Madame Morrible and Linda have been, you could say they're not listening to all what's going on a radio, if there was a radio. And it's so for them, it's visually what they're seeing, perhaps in their head, even though they're sort of veering, looking over the scene. It's like they're in another space. And she's saying, come on, it's as if she's in a room saying, listen, that mob out there, you know, they're doing all those things for all the wrong reasons, and we've got to stop it. We've just absolutely got to stop it. So I feel that that's a good example of the variation of the show, just because I feel like it's three scenes in three different sort of areas.
Yeah, brilliant example. Thank you so very much for sharing that. And there are so many throughout this amazing production of Wicked. It's, you know, it's internationally acclaimed for so many different reasons. Well, thank you very much for answering all of these questions in such rich detail. It's glorious hearing someone talk with such passion, integrity, and knowledge about this fabulous musical and production. Thank you so very much for your time today, Karen Johnson-Mortimer.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
That's all for this episode of The Aside. Thank you hugely to Karen Johnson-Mortimer for giving us her time. She spent over an hour with us answering questions, as well as the questions she's given for the resource pack, which is connected to Wicked as well, which you can access from the Wicked website, which I will link in the episode description. That may be all for this episode, but we have two episodes of The Aside on Wicked, the Unit 3 episode and the Unit 4 episode, and I encourage you to please listen to both. We also have a load of episodes in the bank, over 400 episodes now, on all kinds of different subjects related to the Victorian curriculum, theatre studies, and drama. So feel free to go through those and find one that piques your interest. If you would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, or you'd like to ask us a question, feel free to do so at theasidepodcast@outlook.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Thank you very much to Aaron Searle for providing the music, for Halebury for letting us record here, to Drama Victoria for their ongoing support, and of course, thank you for listening. If you would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, or you'd like to ask us a question, feel free to do so at theasidepodcast@outlook.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Thank you very much to Aaron Searle for providing the music, for Halebury for letting us record here, to Drama Victoria for their ongoing support, and of course, thank you for listening.